saying this is a day only the Lord could pay. When I worked on the levee for my boat on that day, I worked on the levee for my boat on that day. I got to the river and I threw my clothes away. I paid my time and now I'm as good as new. Never keep on raining, I live on a break. Never keep on raining, I live on a break. Some of these people are gonna strip you of all they can take. Don't be a stranger.
baby, keep on raining. That levee is gonna break. It's terrible, Tommy, here in the bunker. Right. Whoa, no, no. That's one only, boy. One only, Bob. Yeah, White Area and Resistance here. Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here on a 17th? 17th, yeah. I should know that. I sent you out a couple of videos. I hope you got them. We're just testing things out here. One of these days we're going to get done testing and do something. Yeah. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And most of you got your dues and donations in here. I appreciate that. And if you don't, try to do it pretty quick here. I appreciate that too. And then go up to resist.com. It's getting modernized and reconstructed and everything up there. Going to be a lot of stuff up there. Taking some stuff out, but adding a lot in. So anyhow, that's that for that. Now here's a story I know you've been looking for. Stand by.
How to baptize your dog growing up. My family had a pretty spotty record with pets. Literally.
How to baptize your dog growing up. My family had a pretty spotty record with pets. Literally my first pet, a goldfish I won at a county fair by deftly tossing rings around milk bottles, was named Spot. Why he was French remains a mystery, but he died not long after we got him because I insisted on bringing him on a family road trip in Santa Cruz from our home near Los Angeles. Turns out, fishes don't do so well in cars, and he is buried somewhere at the Mount Hermon Retreat Center. Later in life, my family got a Yorkshire Terrier puppy. My siblings wanted to name him Elvis, which is a terrible name, and which was mostly because my sister once did an impression of Elvis Presley singing the Gilligan's Island theme song, but instead we named him Winston, after both Churchill and a street in our neighborhood. Winston was a terrible dog. He would not sleep in your bed without moving violently every 5 minutes, he ran away every time the door was open too long. He did not get along with other dogs. But we loved him, as you do the dog of your youth, and even as he grew old and defective, bad teeth, torn ACL, our family lavished affection on him. When Winston was 5 or 6, the question of his eternal life laid heavy on my heart. Where do dogs go when they die? Is the film All Dogs Go to Heaven making a theological claim? How would I survive in my large heavenly mansion without that dumb little guy barking at every angel that walked by? So, I decided to do what any rational Christian person would do, I baptized my dog. Before you get angry and say that I forced him, guess what? I did no such thing. I respected Winston's conscience and decision-making ability, so I set before him a napkin with an image on it that will be familiar to any long-time evangelical Christian. The Jesus Bridge. It looks like this, except I had drawn dog on one side, and God on the other. Nice symmetry, hmm? Next, I asked Winston to place his paw on the cross in the middle, symbolizing Jesus' sacrificial love, bridging the gap between dog and God if he accepted Jesus Christ as his personal Lord and Savior. Lo and behold, his paw moved to the center of the napkin and he looked up at me with large, penitent brown eyes. He was ready. The final step was the baptism itself, which could be performed by no means other than complete immersion. Luckily, our pool was just the right size for a small dog to be reborn in. I held Winston above the water and he began to doggy paddle with his legs. I said, "In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, I baptize you," and dropped him in the water. He swam to the pool steps and jumped out, washed in the blood of the Lamb. Winston died 6 years later, on the operating table, after a bad reaction to the anesthesia that was being used to repair his second torn ACL. It was one of the saddest days of my life. Who knows whether God really lets animals into heaven, but wouldn't it be just like Him to give us the things in heaven that gave us such joy on earth? Hug your dog today.
Thank you, Zira. That was very good. That was very moving. It moved me clear across the bunker floor. Yes, it did. Hey, Tom, you asked for Hitler's speeches in English? Well, they're all over the YouTube, one of our friends told me. Yeah, one, there's even a 50 minutes movie. Well, I didn't ask for it because I'm a Hitler worshiper, far from it. But I did ask for it because I think it would be good once in a while to hear the straight scoop in English of what Hitler actually said. Because all the time on TV and in the movies, they always have him an excitable, screaming, screeching, yelling kind of verbiage, of which anyone who's familiar with the German language at all knows that it sounds like they want to kill you even when they say they love you. Now, the French language, it sounds like they want to love you when they want to kill you. So that's the reason I asked for that. So I sent the sources of all that along to you, and it might be quite interesting to see what he really said compared to what they're inferring he's saying. Well, here's an interesting story about the chosen people. How about this?
According to a recent report published by the Jewish Daily Forward, Serbia's parliament passed a bill giving the organized Jewish community in the Balkan state just over $1 million per year for the next 25 years for property allegedly seized from Jews during and after World War II. Incredibly, the restitution payments are for properties allegedly seized who do not even have heirs, and the money will simply go to the organized Jewish community occupying Serbia. Could it be any more obvious how big of a racket the fake Holocaust narrative is? The organized international Jewish community is literally raking in billions of dollars every single year by promoting the fake Holocaust story, and the vast majority of this money comes directly from taxpayers in the United States and Europe. What an absolute outrage! The Jewish Daily Forward reports, in a move that Holocaust restitution experts called precedent-setting, Serbia's parliament passed a law offering compensation for Jewish property seized during and after the Holocaust without heirs. The law passed Friday by the Narodna Skupština, or the National Assembly, Serbia's parliament, offers annual payments of a little over $1 million for the next 25 years to the country's Jewish communities for property which was confiscated from its Jewish owners during and after the Holocaust, the World Jewish Restitution Organization, or WJRO, said in a statement. While many countries in Eastern Europe allow claims by individual heirs, none so far have enacted laws that offer restitution for Jewish property without heirs, according to WJRO. This is a step toward justice and the recognition of history, WJRO Chair of Operations Gideon Taylor said in a statement issued Friday. We look to other countries to follow Serbia's lead and return heirless Jewish property so that it can help Holocaust survivors in need, commemorate those who died and strengthen Jewish life in these communities where so much was destroyed. In 2009, 46 countries signed a document recognizing the principle of offering compensation for property without heirs, which in countries such as Poland is estimated in the billions. But none have taken such action, until last week, WJRO's acting director, Nakliel Dyson, told JTA. He noted that Hungary did offer limited compensation for heirless property, but not through legislation. The Serbian law, he said, hopefully will make it incumbent on other countries to follow Serbia's lead. Serbia created a procedure for Holocaust restitution of heirs relatively late, in 2011. Speaking on condition of anonymity, a senior restitution official from Israel said that the law, passed with support from Serbia's government, is also connected to Serbia's desire to enter the European Union, where it needs to tick the restitution box. Unbelievable. Of course, the organized Jewish community is going to do everything in its power to ensure other countries in Europe follow Serbia's lead in offering restitution payments of this nature. This is blatant extortion and racketeering on a massive scale. More than 70 years after World War II, the Jews are still collecting literally billions of dollars each year thanks to a fake story they concocted with the help of the various Allied governments, mass media, and Hollywood. The fake Holocaust narrative is a weapon that has been used against the West, giving the Jews unlimited and perpetual sympathy, restitution payments, and a monopoly on our collective historical narrative. In order to the West to be free, this fake story must be exposed, debunked, which has already been done, and rejected. Subscribe to the real...
Well, I won't go so far like a lot of these people do and try to claim there was no large numbers of Jews that died in World War II, during World War II, but remember, 55 million people died in World War II. Most of them are white and non-Jewish. So, if we're going to cry for all the people who died over this horrible mistake that was carried out, we need to cry for them all. The problem with this Jewish thing is highly exaggerated. Now, if they'd have said, like Red Cross, I think, a few hundred thousand people, that would have been accepted, no problem. But when they start talking millions and millions of people, and they can't prove it, well, that's wrong. So we have to find the truth is somewhere in between. Millions of German soldiers and millions of German civilians died during that war, plus all the other peoples of Europe and Eastern Europe and Russia and everything. What we should do, instead of arguing about it all the time, is to make sure it doesn't happen again, because you know how these warmongering bastards and munition makers and all that will start another one if they can, because they make fortunes off of it. And all the leaders of during World War II, they were all guilty of really genocide. I don't care which side they were on. It's time to get back to a pessimist's guide to history again. You need to know what went on way back there. 1798, New England blizzard. High winds and driving snow, lasting from November 17th to the 21st, buried houses in New England under great snowdrifts. Hundreds of people died. So, was it global warming back then? I don't think so. 1799 to 1800, yellow fever ravages Spain and North Africa. A yellow fever plague that began in April 1799 spread relentlessly across Spain and Northern Africa, moving from city to city. The epidemic lasted about 2 to 3 weeks in each place. Everywhere it struck, at least a third of the population perished. And ironically, the strong and healthy tended to succumb first, with the weak and elderly following. During any given outbreak, the death rate surged exponentially each day, and in Fez, Morocco, up to 1,500 people died each day at the height of the epidemic. Survivors had the grim job of shoveling hundreds of corpses at a time into mass graves. Whole villages were virtually wiped out. In one, only 4 people survived out of 600. One observer described the North African villages as uninhabited ruins. Meanwhile, so many wealthy landowners died that whole farms were left without owners. Laborers and servants suddenly found themselves in possession of land, horses, and livestock. They became known as the inheritors. Well, that was a break for the working class. By the time the epidemic ended in 1800, some 80,000 Spaniards and countless thousands of North Africans had died. 1800, British warship sinks after catching fire. The frigate Queen Charlotte was engulfed in flames on March 17th, soon after some hay stored in the deck caught fire. The 700-man crew was unable to extinguish the fire, which soon spread to the rigging and burned through the decks. Nearly all of the crew drowned when the frigate finally sank. 1805, earthquake in Naples and Calabria. The evening of July 26 was unusually cool in Naples, Italy. Then large waves suddenly appeared on the sea. People walking in the surf and on the beach felt the odd sensation of the ground falling away beneath their feet, while the fish rose to the water's surface and splashed wildly. all at once, the first of several and numerous tidal waves struck the city, ringing church bells and stopping the town's clocks at precisely 9:57 p.m. Anxious residents noticed an enormous column of smoke rising above the nearby volcano Mount Vesuvius and could hear two weak explosions within the crater. Several more shocks jolted Naples, Calabria, and surrounding towns that night, knocking down or damaging thousands of buildings in Naples, where 4,000 homes and buildings were demolished. Frightened survivors spent the night on the street or in the open fields. Many inland towns and villages were completely destroyed, their inhabitants crushed beneath their collapsing homes. Some 26,000 people lost their lives. In 1807, Luxembourg Powder magazine explodes. During a storm on June 26, a lightning bolt struck a gunpowder magazine in the fortress at Luxembourg, touching off a tremendous explosion. The blast wrecked part of the city of Luxembourg and killed 230 people. What a boon to humankind the invention of gunpowder was. Yeah, I've been in Luxembourg. That's a nice area. Obviously, they'd rebuilt it since this happened. And they rebuilt it since World War II, too. But I don't think there was any hostilities, or not much, in Luxembourg. I do remember my uncle saying he was a tank commander in World War II. And, no, that wasn't my uncle. My uncle was an artilleryman, a good friend of mine that I worked with that was in World War II. He came through Luxembourg in a tank. But they didn't destroy the place. They just went through on the way to Germany to destroy Germany. 1810, the wreck of the British frigate kills 490. The frigate Minotaur ran aground off Texel, Holland, in the high seas on December 22nd and sank in shallow water. Only 110 of the crew of 590 survived. 1811, the massacre of Mamelukes. Mamelukes, from the Arabic word for owned, were white male slaves who served in special units of the Ottoman Empire. Hey, you hadn't heard that before, did you? White male slaves who served in the special units of the Ottoman Empire. Over the centuries, they gained control of both the military and the government in Muslim-held Egypt, seeking to break the control of the viceroy of Egypt. Muhammad Ali Pasha tricked the Mamelukes into assembling at the citadel in Cairo, and there massacred nearly 500 of them on March 1st. Others not present were hunted down and beheaded. That's one way of getting rid of competition. So those were 500 white guys that had been slaves and broke loose, but then they were recaptured in the Ottoman Empire. So there you go. In 1811, a tornado wrecks Charleston. A deadly tornado, one of the worst ever in the United States, struck Charleston, South Carolina, shortly after noon, September 10th, and razed much of the city. Though the number of the dead was not recorded, one estimate put the death toll at more than 500. Charleston seems to have located in the wrong place. Yeah. Whenever you think things are terrible, think about the pessimist's guide to history. Well, universities all over the country, I'm sure grade schools and high schools are going through this brainwashed white guilt thing. It's just exactly like took place during the Korean War and so forth. Oh, yeah, you're guilty of everything, and you must apologize to everybody for everything. Here's a sample of that. Let's see, let me get it started here. Okay.
White college students are undergoing a weekly Deconstructing Whiteness program at Northwestern University. The six-part workshop series for undergraduate students who self-identify as white launched in January and runs through March, according to the university's website. Students enrolled chose to do so, it is voluntary. A spokesman for the prestigious private university located outside Chicago declined to give the college fixed details on the program, such as how many students enrolled and how it's been received so far. Deconstructing Whiteness, it's part of Northwestern's social justice education effort to create learning opportunities for our students, Bob Rowley, a spokesman for the campus, told the College Fix in an email, providing a link to the social justice webpage and adding, "Beyond that, we don't have anything more for you on it." According to a report in the campus newspaper, the workshops focus on terminology used in conversations of race, the history and meaning of whiteness, white guilt, and the difference between intellectualizing and feeling racism. There's a lot of space on this campus for conversations to happen around issues of privilege and specifically around issues of white privilege, Michelle Enos, assistant director of the university's Social Justice Education Office, told the Daily Northwestern. A poster advertising the workshop series, shown above, posed rhetorical questions such as, "What is my role in doing anti-racist work?" or "Why do I have to feel guilty about being white?" and "How can I talk about race as a white person?" The Daily Caller reports the events are hosted in collaboration with the university's Women's Center. Students applying for the program are required to commit to attend all six sessions, seemingly preventing students from abandoning the program if they don't like it or feel uncomfortable, the Caller reports. The program is a part of Northwestern's Social Justice Education Office, which creates co-curricular educational opportunities in partnership with our student community that foster self-exploration, facilitate conversations across difference, and support actions that create social change on campus, according to its website. Similar programming like the Deconstruction Whiteness Workshop includes student activism workshops that end racist cispatriarchy or programs that navigate real-life diversity issues.
Well, white parents are spending a fortune and going into debt to send their kids off to destroy their white kids. Isn't that peachy keen? Isn't that peachy keen? I think there's got to be one of these days more reaction to this, a blowback to this. And I think you're going to see it develop into maybe even violence. Let's see what's going on with the unindicted criminal conspirator Hillary Clinton, who's guilty as hell of many, many, many things, along with her husband. Remember him, the first Negro president?
Washington, D.C., Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton made the following statement regarding the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, letter to U.S. Department of State Principal Deputy Legal Advisor Mary McLeod concerning the investigation into former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and her staff's use of private email. The FBI letter is a significant development. The FBI confirms for the first time that Mrs. Clinton's use of a private email server is a matter for law enforcement. Why did it take nearly a week for the Obama Justice Department to file this letter with the court? There's now no getting around it. Hillary Clinton's email use could have serious criminal consequences for her and other current and former administration officials. The FBI letter reads as follows. Dear Ms. McLeod, I am writing to update my September 21, 2015, response to your letter dated September 2, 2015, regarding Judicial Watch v. Department of State, 13 CV 1363, DDC, and your request for information pursuant to the court's order of August 20, 2015. At that time, I informed you that the FBI could neither confirm nor deny the existence of any ongoing investigation. Since that time, in public statements and testimony, the Bureau has acknowledged generally that it is working on matters related to former Secretary Clinton's use of a private email server. The FBI has not, however, publicly acknowledged the specific focus, scope or potential targets of any such proceedings. Thus, while the FBI's response to you has changed to some degree due to these intervening events, we remain unable to provide the requested information without adversely affecting ongoing law enforcement efforts. The letter was produced in response to a court order in a Judicial Watch Freedom of Information Act FOIA lawsuit before U.S. District Court Judge Emmett Sullivan. The lawsuit concerns the special government employee status of Huma Abedian, Clinton's former deputy chief of staff, Judicial Watch v. U.S. Department of State, No. 1, 13 CV 01363. Relying upon the State Department's representation that the agency conducted a search of Hillary Clinton's offices, Judicial Watch agreed to dismiss its lawsuit on March 14, 2014. Judge Emmett Sullivan reopened the lawsuit on June 19, 2015, in response to revelations about Clinton's separate email system.
Now, do you think they're going to indict Hillary Clinton? Maybe. But this attorney general under Obama is not going to indict anybody that's in his camp. Look at all the people he's let slide. And under proper conditions, probably even under a Republican administration. They don't prosecute anybody anymore. They don't prosecute the banks. They don't prosecute crooked politicians. Nobody. Nada. And nobody definitely in the ruling class, except maybe gets a slap on the hand. But boy, the working class, man, camp guards from World War II, guys that just stood at the gate, all that kind of stuff. Guys that steal a six-pack of beer, guys that smoke some marijuana. Boy, I'll tell you, they'll get pursued.
Coming up next, a new documentary that examines the tragedy at Waco, Texas.
In the fall of 1993, Treasury and Justice issued their respective reports about Waco.
The United States Congress investigates the debacle that 4 years ago killed 76 men, women, and children who belonged to the Branch Davidian religious sect based in Waco, Texas. In a new documentary called Waco, which clearly attempts to establish that agents from the FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms lied to the Congress and the American people and needlessly harassed and ultimately murdered religious worshipers. To start with, the FBI claims that they fired no shots at the Branch Davidians, but the documentary has hired experts who argue otherwise based on looking at surveillance tapes.
And according to our calculations, it indicates that both positions are firing automatic weapons.
The documentary also argues that the FBI acted out of a macho, don't trifle with us posture toward the Branch Davidians after, to be sure, a 2-month standoff.
When the governmental agency made a decision to breach holds into the building, they set up a configuration of a pot-bellied stove. You wanted to burn slow, you close off the vents. If you wanted to burn fast, you open it up.
Singled out for scorn is the then new Attorney General of the United States, Janet Reno, who the film argues let the FBI run wild and, crucially, walked away from responsibility by choosing to give a speech in nearby Baltimore rather than stay in her office and supervise the FBI's invasion of the Davidian compound.
During the course of the morning, the question arose whether I should cancel the speech, and the FBI did not want me to do so because they thought it would attract attention. If I suddenly canceled a speech, it looked like there would be an emergency.
Waco, the Rules of Engagement. That's the full title of this documentary. It's fascinating in the way it argues that the FBI acted irresponsibly. Would the documentary be stronger if the FBI had been allowed to argue its own case? Yes. Definitely yes. But this is clearly an advocacy piece of filmmaking, and it certainly raised plenty of questions in my mind about how our government handled the Waco tragedy. Thumbs up for me.
Thumbs way up for me, too. And, you know, although it does have a particular point of view, sure, it tries to be fair. It does show information from both sides. But the defenders of the government positions are inarticulate. They are clearly, I think, not saying everything that they're thinking or that they know,
right.
And they're hewing to a party line. You can look in the eyes of the people in this film and tell who you feel is telling the truth and who isn't. And what it amounts to here is that the American people were sold a bill of goods about the Branch Davidians that wasn't necessarily true, that these people were demonized,
yes.
In a way that wasn't accurate. And then boys with toys, Gene.
Yeah,
all those guys who never got a chance to drive a tank before and who were excited and ready to go, like that guy who says, I'm honed to kill.
Yeah.
I'm honed to kill.
Well,
they just couldn't wait to start shooting.
That's why this is an important documentary, in addition to just the case that it deals with. Two things. One, the macho element. Hey, if you're on point for 2 months, mm-hmm. you're going to want to shoot something if you haven't been able to. That's telling us something. And the other one, and I think this is the most interesting one, is how we learn from the media. The fault, ultimately, and I'll pick myself, okay, is that I wasn't as plugged into this story as I should have been. Because I'm getting sometimes a headline.
Of course,
service.
At the time, there was no information available about the other side. And now when you see this film, what's interesting is if you're looking for people who are unbalanced zealots,
right.
You don't find them among the Branch Davidians. You find them among the FBI and the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. Those are the people in this movie who deserve to be feared, I think.
Well, but what I'm saying is that when we do these religious cult stories, when the media does these stories, then they better do a little bit harder reporting. I think that's one of the things you take
out. They should stay away from the trigger words, like cult and compound. How about calling it a religious group and their church? That would have changed the entire perception
because
of what went
on. Because to me, the stunner is who is in that compound. Yeah. Weren't those
sensible, sincere people who were not under the hypnotic leadership.
This is not Jim Jones, and the film makes that, the Guyana story repeatedly makes that comment.
P.S. What was one of the first things Bill Clinton, son of a bitch, did after he won the 1992 election, even before he took office? He ordered the Little Rock office of the ATF to make a case against the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas. And, you know, when things like bad things like this happen, more bad things happen. The Murrah Building went up in Oklahoma City as payback. And the little people never win in these situations. Either the people in the Branch Davidians or just regular workers in the Murrah Building. The working class gets screwed. And I've always found it very bizarre that the FBI and those agencies would put a daycare center in a federal installation like that, knowing full well that any federal installation could become a target for any number of people. So I think that they did it on purpose. Well, I see that Justice Scalia's funeral is set for the largest Catholic church in North America. Saturday's funeral mass at Washington's Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception to follow public viewing Friday at the Supreme Court. Almost all nefarious deaths of important people end up this way, way over eulogizing them and almost worshiping them and to cover up the sins of the fathers. Well, here's some interesting statements by Ben Carson, that deranged black guy running for president, and why he's in there. Who knows why he's still in there at all?
American Muslims who adhere to Islamic Sharia law while also embracing the American values of democracy, including the separation of church and state, must be schizophrenic, Republican presidential candidate Ben Carson said Tuesday.
Oops, I got to get used to this new arrangement here. I got to do more switching.
American Muslims who adhere to Islamic Sharia law while also embracing the American values of democracy, including the separation of church and state, must be schizophrenic, Republican presidential candidate Ben Carson said Tuesday. Only if they're schizophrenic. I don't see how they can do it otherwise, because you have two different philosophies in conflict with each other, he explained to Breitbart News Daily host Stephen Bannon, who had posed the question to the retired neurosurgeon. No stranger to making comments about Muslims, Carson has repeatedly said during his campaign that the president should not be Muslim unless he or she renounces the religion's system of laws and governance. The candidate made similar comments about members of Congress and judiciary. At another point in the interview, Bannon asked Carson to respond to Donald Trump's comments during last Saturday's debate and in the days following, in which he alleged that the Bush administration misled the American public into war following 9/11. I think that's garbage. I've known George W. Bush for a very long time. He is a patriot. He loves America, Carson said. During the interview, he also said that Trump's candidacy could easily collapse once people could start looking very closely at, you know, his beliefs and, you know, people may start looking seriously at the policies that I've put out and other people have put out and actually make a serious decision. Cheney, Trump sounds like a liberal Democrat. Bannon then tried to get Carson to reconcile his praise of the 43rd president with his own rhetoric, referring to Bush's visit to a mosque in the days after the attacks in which he proclaimed Islam a religion of peace. Bear in mind there are a lot of people in this country who will say that same thing, because they bought into it, Carson replied, remarking that he always tells audiences to read about the Prophet Muhammad and why people didn't like him, somebody who lives a life who is in no way comparable to Jesus Christ.
Well, we know two things. George Bush Jr. is a goddamn genocidal maniac for what he did. We all know what he did. A lot of these stupid people and Republicans are in denial. And also we know that Muhammad was a bloodthirsty bastard. I read someplace where he fought 40 wars before he died. Something like that. Doesn't sound like much of a peaceful man to me. Boy, the white rat politicians and the black rat politicians, they're really getting together, man, stroking each other. And Hillary's claiming to high heaven she loves the Negro. She just loves the Negro. And they're all doing that. And even the Republicans, to a degree, the black criminals, the black crooks, the black rats, they know what's going on. Of course, they know what's going on, and they're just as crooked as the white ones because they've learned off the white ones. Where did they learn it? Off the white ones and the Jews. That's where they've learned it, and they're playing the game. They're playing the game for all they can. Yeah, so that's the way it goes in rotten, corrupt American politics. Well, here's some late news from the Middle East you might find quite interesting with the warming up of the friendship between Iran and Russia. What are you going to do about that, Obama? You better be careful.
Tehran, FNA. Iranian Defense Minister Brigadier General Hossein Dekin underlined that Tehran and Moscow are having decisive cooperation to resolve the Syrian crisis, and the same has resulted in a change of power balance in the war-torn country. We are seriously beside the Syrian government and nation, and we have had determining cooperation with Russia, which has resulted in a change of power balance and creation of a new situation for Syria, General Dekin told reporters upon his arrival in Moscow on Monday. The Iranian defense minister reiterated that consultations between Tehran and Moscow on Syria will surely help resolve the Syrian crisis. General Dekin said his present visit to Moscow takes place as the supporters of the terrorist groups in Syria have raised backup for terrorists, adding that Iran's clear stance and policy on Syria is based on confrontation against the terrorists, and ending foreign interference in that country and foreign meddling with the Syrian nation's right to determine their future. The Iranian defense minister also pointed to the strategic cooperation between Tehran and Moscow, and said, reviewing the past agreements to bring faster into result and the issue of Syria will be among the topic to be discussed with the Russian officials during my visit to Russia. General Dekin, heading a high-ranking military and defense delegation, arrived in Moscow earlier today at the official invitation of his Russian counterpart General Sergei Shoigu. The Iranian defense minister will meet Russia senior defense and political officials to discuss bilateral ties and regional developments. Over the last several years, Iran and Russia have had vast cooperation in different fields, especially in defense, political and economic spheres. The two states also enjoy specially common positions on the international scene and have long had constant and regular consultations on key regional and global issues. General Shoigu was in Tehran in January to meet his Iranian counterpart and other officials to further expand relations in different military fields. General Deakin said at the time that the agreement with Russia was meant to enhance and accelerate defensive cooperation between the two countries. "We agreed to accelerate our cooperation in defensive and military technologies," Deakin said in a joint press conference with Shoigu in Tehran last January. The conditions ruling the region and the international issues showed that a powerful Russia in cooperation with an independent and powerful Iran can leave durable impacts on regional peace and security, he added. Deakin underlined that the two countries' leaders were firmly determined to widen and enhance mutual cooperation in all fields. During the press conference, the Russian minister described cooperation between Iran and Russia as a major contributor to the establishment of global and regional security and stability, and said in his meeting with General Deakin, the two sides decided to strengthen practical dimensions of military cooperation between Tehran and Russia. "In these negotiations, we discussed security in the region, the Middle East, and Afghanistan, and our viewpoints were close or similar to each other," he added. "We also exchanged views on the importance of coordination in fighting international terrorism and drug trafficking and underscored the importance of mutual cooperation, considering the regional conditions," General Shoigu said.
Well, I wonder what the Pentagon's thinking about that. I'd like to be a mouse in the room when those generals sit around and read that. And then they try to explain it to the dimwit Obama. Yeah. Well, that's a powerful combination. Russia and Iran. And they've got every reason to cooperate. And the United States has got every reason to back off. Well, that's about it for today, boys and girls. I've done quite a few things around here. Plus, I had to go to my monthly senior class, high school class, luncheon today. To yap at the old people that I used to run around with and do funny things. Yeah, okay. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on that's Thursday. Very important day, and it's a very important day for dates to remember, too, and I'll tell you tomorrow what that's all about. Famous people. I hope you enjoy this electronic speech, because I can put a lot more stuff out this way where you're not stuck reading and reading and reading. I don't know about you, but at my age, I'm getting tired of reading. I like to get it all in audio if I can, so let me know what you think. 14:05, I have nothing to say. Let's hear it again. Come on, kids. I have nothing to say. Bye-bye.
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you forgot, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side. side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep them laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
I'm a fine cheer up.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
First things that we see, you know.
Always look on the right side of life.
What are you going to lose? You know, you come from nothing, you go back to nothing. What are you lost?
Always look on the right side of life.
Nothing will come from nothing, you know what I say?
Cheer up, you old bugger.
Come on, give us a grin. There you are. Incidentally, this record's available
always
in the foyer.
Some of us got to live as well,
who do you think pays for this rubbish?
Always look on the right side of life.